Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we're going to be reading part 5 of A Clean Slate, written by Jarrett. I hope you enjoy this story. I'm not an AI voice. Let me know what you thought of this story in the series so far. Let's get started. December 12th, 1969. The DMV's hours on Polk Street were reduced on Fridays. Even so, Julie stood outside promptly at 10 a.m., to see if she could get answers on the van's license plate. She'd gotten her photo reel developed at Kmart late yesterday afternoon, and had gotten clear, distinct pictures of everything, van plate included. Julie strode in, chin lifted just enough to look like she belonged. It was all a facade. She was scared to hell. Her eyes fell upon the lonely sucker instantly. Dean Rourke. Hair slicked back in that stubborn 1950s greaser way. Shirt tight around the shoulders, a tie knotted like he still believed in things like protocol and morning briefings. His desk nameplate was scuffed but legible, and he wasn't old, mid-30s maybe. Julie approached, slowly, mustering up all the confidence her eroded nerves would allow. She smiled like she'd seen him before and fluttered her eyelashes at him like a stupid schoolgirl. "Hi there," she said softly, just loud enough for his ears and no one else's. Dean looked up, startled as she slowly unbuttoned the top of her blouse, exposing her cleavage. She watched his posture shift, spine straightening, pupils adjusting. "Can I help you, miss?" She leaned on the counter, her body curved delicately toward him, showing off her curves. She set the folder down and slid it open with care. A photograph lay inside, black and white, a license plate, blown up to 5x7. "I really hope so." She licked her lips and flashed him a devilish stare. "I'm looking for the owner of this van. You think you could help me?" Dean squinted, then shifted his gaze to her. "And what's your business with it?" Julie smiled and shrugged, pulling her leather gloves off one finger at a time. "Let's just say it's an investigative matter." She cocked her head. "Between us." Dean raised a brow. "You, law enforcement?" "Do I look like a cop?"
"Yeah, kinda."
"Well, let me put you at ease. No, I'm not. Not exactly." She lowered her voice. "But if I'm right about this van's tied up with, well, let's just say I might be able to save a child's life."
Dean's jaw tensed.
"I'm not supposed to. Do anything without proper forms?"
"I know," Julie said, speaking in a velvety, sultry tone. She reached into her coat pocket and pulled out her old, expired press badge from college. Old, faded, but laminated.
"Julie Isley, the Beacon. Just looking for a lead. A thread."
He stared at the badge, then at her lips. She saw it happen. She let it.
"I know you're not supposed to give me the name," she said, tracing a finger along the folder's edge. "But if you were to do me a kindness, I'd owe you one."
She popped out one of her cheeks, insinuating fellatio. Dean swallowed.
"A name," she murmured. "A company. Anything."
She offered a slow, private smile.
"And maybe a drink after, if you're feeling like showing a girl a good time."
He blinked. She watched the shift, saw the gears stutter, grind, then click into place. He looked down, sighed, and opened a drawer. A thick binder, pages flipping. "I don't know why I'm doing this," he muttered.
"Yes, you do," Julie said, brushing a lock of her hair behind her ear, giving him a hint of collarbone. "You're a gentleman. That's rare these days."
He stopped on a page. "Not a city plate," he said. "Not state either. Registered to, Bradley's Special Courier Services." Julie's stomach turned. She smiled through it.
"That, out of Massachusetts?"
Dean shook his head. "Maryland, Montgomery County."
"Do you have an address?"
she asked, just barely above a whisper. Dean hesitated. She reached across the counter and caressed the hollow of his throat seductively, tracing her fingernail down his chest.
"I'm not asking for a full file, just a lead. I'm careful. I don't cause trouble. Not unless it's fun."
That made him blush. He scribbled something onto a DMV receipt pad, tore it off, and folded it in half. He passed it across the desk. She took it slowly, their fingers grazing. She tucked it into her coat pocket and gave a small, genuine smile. Then she reached into her purse, pulled out a lipstick-smeared receipt, and jotted something on the back. "My number," she said, "in case you want that drink. And other things." He looked down at the scrap of paper. It was a red XOXO, but no number. "Hey, you said..." "Thanks, Dean," she purred, brushing the counter with her fingertips. "You've been a real lifesaver." And then she was gone. Once outside, she dug into her pocket and opened the note Dean had scrawled for her. The address, Unit C, 1841, Halpine Sector, Montgomery County, Maryland. She had her sights set on it. Sitting in a drive-in restaurant during the midday lunch rush, a burger half-eaten, Julie shuffled deeper into Henry's stack of papers, guzzling a milkshake as she pulled out a manila folder she hadn't gone over before. It had pencil mark in the corner, Q4 allocations, Bradley. Inside, a thick batch of photocopied documents, some stapled, others paper-clipped, all of them looking like they'd been crammed in haste. The first few were dry, federal budget memos, pages filled with dense jargon and acronyms. But then came something different, a cost ledger. Top sheet, internal use only, Bradley Institute for Behavioral Advancement, quarterly expense report, October to December 1969. Funding channel, Title I Enrichment Adjustment, Subsection E, Diversion Authorization, Behavioral Advancement Clause, Section 5.7-B. Routing agent, Department of Educational Reintegration and Surveillance, DERS. Memo origin, Behavioral Pathways Oversight Subcommittee, BPOS. Final approval, Kessler, HA. Regional Medical Consultant, Bradley Institute, Maryland Division. Expense breakdown, Tier 4 Program, Site C, $32,750. For IQ test batteries, Stanford, Binet, and Wechsler, assorted formats. $48,300, neurological imaging equipment, contracted via MedRay Systems, D.C. $18,900, Class 4 hallucinogens, psychotropic testing batch, Schedule 1, marked as conditional research only. $9,240, surgical scalpels, forceps, suture kits, Grade A pediatric spec. $11,000, general anesthesia reserves, morphine, halothane, ketamine compound. $6,400, steel frame restraint cots, child-sized. $3,200, reinforced windowless transport units, unmarked, includes Bradley Courier Service logistics surcharge. $7,100, audiometric and speech pathology diagnostic tools, Tier 3-B classification. Note, per memo COM-1948-41, these costs are approved for indirect routing via Title I Enrichment Fund reallocation. All expense justifications to be omitted from LEA, Local Educational Agency, disclosure reports for internal use only. Julie's mouth went dry. These weren't just student evaluations or behavioral programs. These were procedures. Trials, controlled testing. The name Kessler jumped out at her. She rifled back to the first page and saw his signature scrawled confidently in blue ink above a stamped approval date, 11-23-69. Kessler, regional medical consultant, not school board, not even district. A doctor? She turned to the next document and found a shipping manifest. Destination Site C, Riverbrook Treatment Annex Courier, Bradley Special Courier Services, license number BR-8812, contents classified, appendix C, 6 times crates, anesthesia compound, 3x containers, pediatric immobilization tools, 4 times cartons, cognitive performance evaluation kits, 2 times cylinders, laboratory gas, unlisted. The manifest was stamped received December 6th, 1969. She turned one final page. A memo to Kessler, marked confidential. Per Directive OAP-5D, IQ assessment must precede corrective implementation. Ensure Tier 3 subjects are isolated prior to stratification. Volunteers may be reintroduced, but reassignees must remain quarantined post-correction. No Tier 4 integration under any circumstance. Julie blinked. Stratification. Quarantine. Correction. She circled Kessler's name and scribbled next to it. Who is Kessler? Why would a medical consultant be rerouting education funding? Because Bradley is a medical institution. Obvious conclusion. She stared at the folder, then out the window, her mind already racing ahead to Maryland. Where could she go for safety? Home? Out of the question. The police department? No. What if Baker had said about that house fire was true? Who could she trust there? Then she knew. She turned right, heading for the Beacon's offices. Julie slammed the door shut in Burke's office, her face beet red, her breaths coming through in rough, ragged pants from the running. Her editor shot to his feet as she turned to face him.
Julie? What in the world? I've been trying to call you for days, but your phone's been off the hook.
Walking around the desk, he put his hands on her quaking shoulders. Julie staggered forward, gasping.
Something's happening at the schools,
she managed, collapsing into the armchair across his desk. Her coat hung limp off her shoulders, her hair damp from melted snow. Burke pulled the blind shut, turned the lock on the door, and crouched low in front of her.
What are you talking about?
She shoved her folder into his chest.
I have proof. Funding. It's not even real school funding, it's medical. They're taking kids, Ken.
Her voice broke.
They're hurting them.
Burke rose, skimmed the top page, then flipped to the confidential memo from Kessler. Her eyes didn't widen, they narrowed.
You said you've been trying to call me?
Julie said, her voice quivering.
Why? You told me to take a vacation. Who told you to find me?
Burke didn't answer right away. He walked back around his desk, hand drifting to the top drawer. Finally, he said,
I got a call from Leary Elementary a few days ago, saying that you were snooping around and asking too many questions. Questions about the Child Advancement Division.
Julie's pulse slammed against her skull. She rose slowly from the chair as Burke said,
You shouldn't have dug so deep, Julie. When I first assigned this to you, I told you, do the bare minimum. Write a few hundred words, just an update for the paper. But no, you didn't listen. You dug, and what did it get you?
Burke opened the top desk drawer. Inside, a revolver. Burke snatched it and pointed it at Julie's chest.
Julie stumbled back, knocking into a coat rack. Wait, no, Ken, don't!
Burke shrugged.
Henry was warned too, he said. I told him to drop it. That he was digging into a very nasty, very deep hole, but he didn't listen. None of you ever listen.
She gasped, realization crashing down.
It was you, she whispered. The brakes. You cut his brake lines.
Burke seethed like a lambasting child.
What did you expect?
He cocked the hammer back.
Ken, how could you?
He shrugged casually.
Accidents happen. It's not personal, but I have to choose between my hide and someone else's. Well, it's not gonna be me.
But why?
Why? You wanna know why? My son. He came out all slow and messed up in the head. They fixed him. I don't know how. I don't wanna know how, but he's normal now. But I couldn't afford it, so I repay them in other ways.
Julie felt bile rise in her throat. Her mind reeled, scrambling for exits, for weapons, for options.
You sold Henry out. You killed him, she said.
You have no idea what you've got yourself into. They'll find you. They'll kill you.
Julie backed toward the door, feeling for the knob, without looking away. Burke's voice was almost tender.
You're smarter than him, Julie. Walk away.
Julie's hand found the lock. She twisted it slowly.
If you leave, I can call them off, Burke offered. Let you live your life. But just forget about it.
Her lip trembled.
And if I don't?
He didn't answer. His lips hardened into a line. An impending sense of doom consumed her. Julie twisted the doorknob and ducked, just as Burke fired, the gunshot sounding like a cannon as the glass spiderwebbed. A chorus of startling shouts and screams filtered in from the newsroom as people rose from chairs and stared slack-jawed. Julie tore across the workstations, weaving between desks and reporters staring on in horror. Somewhere behind her, Burke bellowed her name, the gun raised. She flew through the front door so hard it rebounded off the wall. Outside now, down the icy steps. "Don't trip," another gunshot cracked from behind her. Julie ducked low as she sprinted. She put her arms behind her, traversing the icy sidewalk as fast as she could. She didn't stop until she reached the alley across the street. She crouched low behind a dumpster, chest heaving, peeking out just in time to see the office doors swing open again. Burke stumbled out, alone, but he didn't chase her. Instead, he stood in the doorway, gun still clutched in one trembling hand. His hair was mused, his tie askew. He looked around the street with haunted hollow eyes, like a man who had just realized he was already dead. His eyes scanned the alley, and when they passed right over her without displaying recognition, she saw the moment Burke broke. She stayed silent as Burke pressed the barrel of the gun underneath his own chin. He hesitated a split second, mouthed something she couldn't catch, then pulled the trigger. His head exploded like a grapefruit as he dropped like a sack of potatoes in the beacon's doorway. Reporters inside screamed.